Mahmud's Jihad, subtitle, Articles of Faith Sometimes Need Editing, a novel by Geoffrey Dutton. Dedicated to the people of Iraq and Syria who, through little fault of their own, have been subjected to barbarous rulers and foreign meddlers that have caused them enormous, unnecessary, and cruel losses and suffering, their manifold tragedies must not go unnoticed or unredeemed. All characters with speaking parts in Mahmud's Jihad are fictional and are not intended to represent any actual persons living or dead. Some of the other characters mentioned do represent actual people. Their names have been changed. Most of the locations mentioned in the book are actual places in Greece and Turkey. Certain events referred to actually did happen. Part 1. Seeking Refuge. We have awoken, and all creation has awoken. For Allah, Lord of all the worlds, Allah, I ask you for the best this day has to offer. Victory, support, light, blessings, and guidance. And I seek refuge in you from the evil in it and the evil to come after it. The Dawn Prayer. Chapter 1. He had just started walking when a seabird swooped toward him with a sharp shriek, as if to remind him he had forgotten to do something important. So there, in a chill morning mist that obscured all but the blue dawning sky, Mahmud al-Ramadi lowered himself to his knees facing the sea. As he had still been afloat at the appointed hour of devotion, he now offered Farshala, the dawn prayer. The soothing ritual, while it lasted, obliterated the keening and nattering from across the pebbly strand where he and dozens of others had disembarked. He recited his two rakhas, adjusted his cap, and slowly arose to survey the human specters huddling nearby. Most of these ghosts, he assumed, were displaced, dispossessed beings like himself, seeking salvation from grisly circumstances. He shared their aspirations for better days abroad, but while almost all would make long, fraught pilgrimage north, his odyssey would pause 200 kilometers to the west, or so he hoped. Through lifting fog, he spied a jeep and two white vans approaching along a two-lane road. Security personnel or relief workers, he assumed. Having been cautioned not to get caught up in rescue operations, he took his leave, picking his way along the shoreline, avoiding migrants, cast-off life preservers, and the sorry flotsam of improvised adjacency. Plastic bottles and bags, a shoe, a scarf, even a pair of eyeglasses. A man, with no complexion, reposed on his side, half-submerged, someone he might have even seen before. Mahmud hauled him onto the beach by the armpits and squatted beside him, ear pressed to chest. No breath or heartbeat, only the racing of his own blood. He pumped on breastbone until no more water spat out, then clamped onto purple lips to breathe life back into the luckless middle-aged man, without success. So close after traveling so far for so long, such a shame. The man's right hand still clutched the strap of an oblong bag. Mahmud worked it from his fingers, dragged it away, and unzipped it. Inside were sneakers, clothing, packaged food, a Quran, a cell phone, and a half-soaked leather purse tied with a drawstring attached to a lanyard. A glance up and down the beach brought him to his feet with the purse stuffed inside his jacket. "Your misfortune grieves me," he murmured to his mute benefactor before walking on. "May Allah be with you in paradise." His unfeigned remorse for robbing a corpse was soon tempered by the thought, Allah has provided this not for me, but for his work. At the berm of the beach, he crossed the road and strode uphill, heading north. When he'd lost sight of the beach, he stopped to examine the contents of the purloined purse. Besides a roll of worthless Syrian dinars, it held several small gold coins and pieces of gold and silver jewelry, some with precious stones. Mahmud smiled and gave silent thanks for his ticket to Piraeus. The road veered from the coast and wound through scattered houses and vineyards to a more barren landscape. Cresting a hill, he spied the harbor he'd noted from his overburdened Zodiac that sheltered several sailboats and fishing boats. Squinting revealed movement on one of them, and he hastened downhill, stopping at a weathered store squatting beside two rust-hot gas pumps. The slam of the screen door behind him roused the old woman at the counter to follow his rummaging with anxious eyes. Seizing a red plastic 10-liter gas can, he mimed to the matron his desire for some petrol, offering a fistful of dead man dinars. She held one of the bills up to a dusty window, shrugged, and wrinkling her nose, tossed it back, muttering something he was glad he could not understand. Mahmud scooped it up and in its stead presented a tarnished silver bracelet set with cerulean lapis. Her beady eyes glinted and her expression softened. She fingered the piece for a moment, tucked it in her tunic, and waved him out to take the fuel and be gone. He topped off his canister with diesel and sloshed down to the Limani. On one boat, a man was stretched on a pile of fishing nets with his feet on the gunwales, chewing a cigar. As he approached, Mahmud fished out a gold ring with several small diamonds and another with what seemed to be an emerald, and slipped them both on his left little finger. Displaying his multiple offerings, he hailed the boat's occupant, shouting, "Athens! Piraeus!" The fisherman most likely had been laying about that morning considering how he could profit from the frantic castaways down the coast, and now one had come to him. He struggled up and sniffed the contents of the gas can as Mahmud ceremoniously offered up the rings. The mariner turned them in his leathery fingers, pocketed them, and with a sly smile, again presented his palm. Aware he was at a disadvantage, Mahmud reluctantly extracted a gold coin from his purse, proffered it, and waved, "Enough." His enticements worked. The captain motioned him aboard the vessel and cast off from the stone pier. Mahmud followed him to the wheelhouse. As the wooden boat puttered past the jetty, the captain unrolled a coastal chart. Over his shoulder, Mahmud located the port of Piraeus and traced a line to it, and received an affirmative nod. The Aegean shimmered blue under a soft offshore breeze that barely ruffled its swells. Mahmud perched himself on the foredeck, back to the whales, grimly recalling how his commander had urged him to dispatch whoever ferried him and toss him overboard before entering port, lest he tell tales. But unwilling to betray the mariner who would shepherd him through strange waters, he decided the order was moot. Let the captain tell whom he will. No one would think twice about his helping a refugee move on. 20 minutes out to sea, a small ship looking like a Coast Guard vessel broke the horizon. Deciding he needed a hiding place, Mahmud found he was sitting on one, a hatch cover. He shoved it away and jumped in to hunker and bilge in the company of rotting fish carcasses, nauseously rocking in the wake of the passing ship. When the sloshing stopped, he warily boosted himself up, replaced the cover, and lay on it. When he judged it was noon, he faced the stern and made 2 rakaz of jur, the noonday prayer. He recited prayers as often as he could. He didn't swear, smoke, or fornicate, and had rarely tasted alcohol. He had come to feel his prayers sometimes were heard. Considering all the perils he had recently negotiated, had he been a blasphemer, he would have called himself damned lucky. As daylight dimmed, Piraeus approached. The sturdy old boat puttered past high rises perched on the shadowed cliffs of Piraki in gathering dusk. Mahmud gestured at a quiet cove away from the busy harbor. His pilot obliged and nosed in as far as he dared. Before wading ashore, Mahmud tipped him with a $50 bill and for more fuel. There, on a patch of sand under an embankment, queasy, half-soaked, weak, he offered evening prayer and then reposed with his head propped on his backpack. He had a right to be tired. His revolutionary path, which had been assured would be righteous and glorious, now stretched across 3,000 kilometers. As a reward for saving his life, his commander at the Eastern Front had sent him off to Greece to be a key player in a special operation disclosing nothing of its nature. Whatever that mission was to be, he knew it wouldn't animate the ashes of his parents in Mosul, and that was the point. Some serious avenging needed to be done. Most of what jihad had entailed so far, he could have done without. His battalion's bitter retreat into Turkey after dodging ISIS bullets in Tal Aiba, then being put into a lorry to lurch across Anatolia in the company of Kurds, who he had to pretend were his saviors and was now glad to be rid of. At the edge of Asia Minor, having to trust his fate to seedy smugglers who relieved him of much of his money for the privilege of rafting to Chios, crammed against mothers anxiously stroking wailing children and furiously bathing fathers, having survived all these and other miracles, here he was in Europe, feeling thankful, ill-prepared, and adamant. He clasped his hands behind his head and stared into the darkening sky, telling himself, "I can do, must do this, which was meant to be, for Allah, for Iraq, for my parents and my brother, for liberation, for salvation." His eyes soon closed and he slept fitfully until dawn. Vivid dreams, borne by disorientation and pangs of hunger, soothed his slumbering brain. He was in a small orchard on a verdant, sunlit mountain slope. Comely maidens were plucking apples from trees, laughing and smiling as they filled their baskets with ripe red fruit, their breasts gyrating under their flowing gossamer robes. In the distance, atop a hill, a flag fluttered on a tall pole. "No virgins for you yet," a voice told him. "You must first climb that hill." Yawping seabirds and gray glimmers of light extinguished his dream, leaving him with hunger, a headache, and a hard-on. He picked himself up and gazed up at the rocky escarpment he would have to climb to reach the promised flag. But first he knelt to the rising sun to offer Far Salah, after which he relieved himself in the bay, stripped away his salt-stiffened clothes, donned khaki pants and a blue polo shirt from his backpack, and interred the foul garments he had worn for weeks under sand and rocks. He drained his canteen to his parched mouth, scrambled up the steep slope, and boosted himself onto asphalt. There, on an esplanade along the bay, he surveyed his surroundings, a row of tall, balcony-laden buildings. At the next corner, he came upon a sidewalk cafe he would have entered were it not shuttered. Soon the street diverged from the bay into the shadows of apartment blocks. He trudged through the canyon, hoping to be greeted by a place to eat and a public telephone. His quest was rewarded at a large intersection with a small cafe open for business. Hunger drove him inside to gulp down a half liter of water and tear into a square of spanakopita, bread, olives, tomatoes, and a refreshing tea for an eagerly accepted $10 bill. Spreading his fingers into the universal phone gesture, he asked the proprietor, "Telephone!" and was waved down across street. A brisk 5-minute walk brought him to a bus stop and close by a payphone. Hoping that it worked, he inserted his phone card and punched in his contact's number from memory, praying that he had gotten it right and that the call would go through without interception. Anxiety swelled as the number started to ring. His contact's code name had slipped from his mind. He managed to retrieve it along with his own nom de guerre, just as a gruff voice spoke in Turkish. "Efendim!"
"George, is that you?" Mahmoud replied, also in Turkish. "Who is this?"
"It's Peter," breathed Mahmoud. "I am here, praise Allah."
"I have been waiting, Peter." "I've heard good things about you. We have much to do. Did you come alone, I hope?"
"Oh, yes, I paid a man to take me here from Chios, a fisherman. Now what should I do?"
"Your host awaits you. Do you know where to find him?"
Mahmoud suppressed a snort. "Of course not. I don't even know where I am or what day this is."
George's voice lowered and hissed. "It's Saturday. No one gave you his address."
"No, I would have remembered it," Mahmoud told him, adding, "I thought you would board me."
"Not me. Where are you? Describe it."
"On a long street at a bus stop. It's spelled X-A-T-Z-H-K something. Behind me is a wall around what looks like a campus or park, and I see water way down the street."
"What direction are you walking?"
"Looks like the street goes north," Mahmoud said, noticing the morning sun at his right. It's very straight. George told him to hold on while he consulted his city map. Mahmoud stood nervously, his back turned to traffic, until George picked up and told him,
I know where you are. It's called Marius Chatzakakurov Street. Keep walking north. The street will end near some cruise terminals at the boulevard called Akhti Mayuli.
When you get there, go to the nearest bus stop and pretend you're waiting for a bus. Our comrade will meet you there and take you to his place.
How will he know me?
Tell me what you were wearing. Mahmoud described himself, 180 centimeters tall, ragged black beard, dark brown eyes, blue shirt, khaki trousers, grimy tan windbreaker, baseball cap, and a black backpack. George said, be there in half an hour and stay put. He's on his way.
His name is Andreas, and he will know you as Peter. Do not use your actual name, whatever it is. No one needs to know.
George clicked off before Mahmoud could ask him what Andreas looked like. Maria Chatzakiraku Street sloped down before him, long and straight, ending in a patch of dark blue water. He started walking toward it at a brisk pace, chanting, Andreas Peter, Andreas Peter. Sooner than he expected, the street ended at the edge of a circular parking area overlooking several cruise terminals. Next to him was what looked like a church with a cross atop a tower. No activity, only a scattering of city buses occupied the divided road that ran by it.
It should be easy for Andreas to see me here.
At the empty bus stop in front of the church, he paced the sidewalk. Feeling too conspicuous, he retreated to the corner of the church to impatiently loiter. After about 10 minutes, a police car came down Marius Chatzikiriaku and stopped at the intersection. Its driver eyeballed him from behind his shades before turning right and slouching down the boulevard. A few fidgety minutes later, a police car, possibly the same one, approached from that direction. It passed by, doubled back, and stopped in front of him. Mahmoud stood warily erect, his mouth suddenly dry as the driver got out and approached. Yes, it was the same cop. He was used to having strangers, Kurds, Turks, Syrians, superiors, take his measure, but being profiled by the Greek police wasn't part of this repertoire.
What can I do? I can't speak Greek, and if he finds my documentation, I'll be detained for sure.
Unwelcome visions of months in a filthy jail cell and deportation hearings flashed before his eyes as the officer verbally assailed him in Greek. Instinctively, Mahmoud waved his hands in bewilderment. The cop gave him the once-over, followed by another indecipherable question or command. Mahmoud unconsciously clenched and unclenched his fingers, causing him to think, maybe I can give some mind death. He started gesturing as if he were signing, voicing grunts and mumbles for effect. The cop seemed to get it because he started speaking louder and more slowly. Emanating frustration with Mahmoud's impromptu miming, the officer pointed to his backpack, gesturing for him to remove it. Out of options, Mahmoud shrugged and was about to obey the order when he heard a voice from his right calling, Peter! Peter! And turned to see a man running toward them on the sidewalk, blonde ponytail flapping. The man sprinted up and hugged him as the officer looked on. With his hand firmly attached to Mahmoud's shoulder, he spoke in Greek to the officer, who now began questioning the stranger. Could this be Andreas? It seemed to Mahmoud much longer, but probably only a minute passed before the officer turned and went back to his car.
Andreas, Mahmoud hissed, is that you?
His new friend nodded and, draping his arm around Mahmoud's shoulder, started piloting him along the boulevard. Soon he stopped, stepped back, and started to mime sign language at Mahmoud, whispering,
keep waggling your fingers.
Mahmoud complied, and they pantomimed as the police car overtook them and sped away.